Okay, we're back with another episode of More from Sam, where we get more from you, Sam.
Yes, good luck.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. Good to see you. Before we get into things, I just want to quickly remind everyone that you will be giving talks in a number of cities in 2026. Los Angeles, Dallas, Austin, Portland, Vancouver, Palm Beach, Toronto, Washington, D.C., and New York City. Last time we warned Portland to start buying tickets or we were going to cancel, and that seemed to work. So good news, the show is still happening. If you want to see Sam live, this is the time to do it. And it's a really great talk. Republicans and Democrats alike will be thrilled.
Both hate it. Yeah.
And annoyed, just like this podcast. Okay, on to our first topic. Last year, you made a New Year's resolution where you essentially planned to live like you were dying. I want to know how that went for you and if you're making any adjustments to that plan for 2026, or is that just
the plan
for the rest of your life?
No, I think I rephrase it this, live as though it were my last year, yeah. I mean, it was a great frame to put over the year. The year didn't quite become what I expected because 7 days into it, half the city burned down and I had to flee my house, which didn't burn happily, but we still haven't been back. So, you know, the year got jiggered around by real estate concerns way more than I was anticipating. And I wouldn't expect to spend the last year of my life on that.
But did that help you actually sharpen up your goal a little bit more?
It played a little havoc with it. I mean, in terms of actually the content of what I was paying attention to, it was more, more terrestrial and practical than I would have hoped for. But it was, I would give myself maybe a B on this aspiration. I mean, I think I did have my priorities pretty straight. I mean, the filter for me with respect to the podcast is, there would be less, if I could really do this, I think there would be less politics, or I mean, the level, the cut would be higher. I mean, it would really be sort of emergency politics more than just, okay, here's another thing in the news that I can't help but respond to.
Well, you're going to hate this episode then.
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to be, this is probably not going to be a moment of me walking my talk, but no, it was good. I would do the same. I think I'll do the same year after year because it's really, obviously one doesn't know how many one has left. And no regrets that was my resolution.
All right, good. I think we're all addicted to social media and our phones at this point, and our attention has become so fragmented that it's almost impossible to fully be anywhere anymore. Is there a quick pitch for the Waking Up app you can throw in here?
Well, we often demonize the smartphone as the locus of all of our fragmentation and collective derangement. I think that's true, but obviously there are different uses of a smartphone, and this is certainly one that I can stand behind as being just categorically different from the other stuff that's driving us crazy. And I view most of the audio I consume on a phone, which is a lot, as some version of, kind of very productive and unifying of my attention. I mean, I listen to good books and good conversations and, listen to guided meditations and meditation instruction is, I think, kind of the ultimate example of a good use of attention on this device, which is just not at all analogous to having your attention, shattered on the regular by social media engagement and kind of the dopaminergic checking in to the response, to the response, to the response. So yeah, I think Waking Up I love what we've created over there. And I think it's a great use of the device,
Can you give us some examples of what types of results one could expect once they develop this skill that could, I think honestly take somebody about a week to really begin to see something, but what kind of results can one expect?
Yeah, I love these questions. This is exactly the way I come at it. Hope the irony was detectable there. I mean, so there are kind of two sides to this topic, right? There's the conventional mainstream pitch for mindfulness that, here's a list of benefits you can expect from the practice. And most of what is claimed there, I think, is true. I mean, so some of it is poorly researched, or at least the research is kind of thin, and some of it might wash out. But the thing that is obviously true is that virtually everyone, until they learn to practice mindfulness in some form, is spending their life perpetually distracted, and they're so distracted they're not even aware of that, right? They're thinking every moment of their lives. Their moment-to-moment experience of being a self in the world is being filtered through this discursive, conceptually framed conversation they're having with themselves. And again, the conversation is so incessant and so loud that it achieves this kind of white noise status, whereas so people aren't even aware that they're distracted. I mean, half the people hearing me say this who have never tried to meditate will be thinking, what the hell is he talking about, right? But it's that voice in the mind, what the hell is he talking about that feels like you? That's the endless conversation that is defining your experience moment to moment. And it's the medium on which all of your dissatisfaction and frustration and regret and annoyance and everything that makes you an asshole in the world, it is the medium that transmits that and makes it actionable in emotionally and behaviorally moment to moment. It's like it's the capture by thought unwittingly, right? The impulse that you can't see creep up from behind that just becomes you, that becomes your, the next thing you say, the next thing you reach for, the next thing you aspire to become. I mean, it's just, again, we're living in a dreamscape and virtually nobody notices. So when you try to practice meditation for the first time, really any form of meditation, but mindfulness in particular, initially you're given this very basic exercise of just try to pay attention to the breath, try to pay attention to sounds, moment by moment. And every time you notice you're lost in thought, come back to the feeling of breathing or the sounds in your environment or the sense of your body resting in space or just some sensory experience that you can use to try to build some concentration on. And it is, if you persist in it long enough to notice how hard that is and how vulnerable your attention is in every present moment to the next thought arising unrecognized and just seeming to become you, it is a kind of revelation. I mean, albeit a negative one. I mean, what you recognize in yourself is this pervasive incapacity to pay attention to anything for more than a few moments at a time without being distracted. And it's very hard, but whatever you think about meditation from that moment forward, maybe you think it's just too much of a hassle, you're too restless, it's too hard, you don't have a talent for it, you're going to move on to other things, and you kind of bounce off the project. Even if you fall into that condition, I think it should be very hard to argue to yourself that this is somehow psychologically optimal to not be able to pay attention to something for more than a few moments at a time and to be helplessly buffeted by the winds of your own distraction.
I had a good thought actually about that. I wanted to run by you. There's this idea of sort of like a dealer dealing cards, like thoughts. And imagine sitting at the card table, blackjack table, just every time, just waiting for the cards. Don't want to play that card. You can wait for a blackjack every time if you know how to wait for the cards. You don't have to play the card that's dealt. You can say, I don't want that one. Don't want that one. And everyone at the table is looking at you like, this guy's cheating. And it's kind of like cheating. But if you have that skill, it's kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. The cards are thoughts, right? Thoughts taken seriously. Yeah, so, the voice of your mind says, oh, I can't believe how you fucked that up, right? And what does that convey, right? Like how much shame or regret or what do you do with that? You don't have to do anything with it.
You tell the dealer to give you another card.
Yeah. I mean, there's this image in Tibetan Buddhism ultimately thoughts are like thieves entering an empty house. Right? There's nothing for them to steal, right? So that, just imagine what that's like. Imagine the scene of thieves come storming into a house that has nothing in it, right? I mean, there's no implication of their presence there, right? That there's nothing for them to do. Thoughts recognized are just these mysterious mental objects, right? I mean, they really don't it is just a bit of language or a bit of imagery, and it is genuinely mysterious that. This next thought can so fully commandeer your physiology and your whole sense of being in the world. I mean, the next thought taken seriously could define the next decade of your life if you can't see some reason not to take it seriously. So meditation on some level is a way of relaxing the hold that thoughts automatically have on us.
Yeah. As we move into 2026, I hope people will develop a practice or give this a look. Check out Waking Up. And if not waking up, there are plenty of other apps where you can learn to meditate because it really is a basic skill that you should if you don't go super deep, that's fine, but you should have a basic understanding and just explore that for yourself. And it's life-changing. So if anyone's focused on nutrition and physical fitness and sleep, you're missing this aspect. If you care about those three and you're not caring about your mind, you're missing this. All right, on to our next topic. I really liked your podcast with Ross Douthat, that recent one. He's very likable and very smart. And I think it was the first time I liked an argument for why God, a perfect God, would put a bad idea like slavery in the Bible, where he basically had said that he knew it was bad, but wanted to allow room for Christians to evolve and to sort of put their fingerprints on it over time. Now,
he says, that was a good argument.
No, he said, if that's not good for you. No, I wasn't persuaded by it, but I actually liked it. Yeah. I thought, oh, that's a well-made argument that he's explaining that God wanted to make room for Christians to evolve and to...
Well, it's well-made in the sense that it's totally unfalsifiable and it could absorb anything, any possible contents of the Bible, even mathematical errors, right? I mean, I think pi is calculated somewhere in the Bible as 3, full stop. I think I have that right. I mean, I think it's said that the circumference of a circle is with a diameter 1 is 3 or something like that. But okay, so God can't do math. Well, he's waiting for us to get better at math. I mean, he's leaving room for our own genius to explore that topic. It's just idiotic. I mean, I guess maybe I'm in an uncharitable mood around this, but I mean, as at a certain point, we have to run out of our patience with these dodges. I don't know how you spend your life circling that specific attractor again and again, year after year. I mean, it's just so obviously wrong and foolish. I mean, we'd have no patience for it. If this wasn't grandfathered in by this tradition, I mean, again, you just look at the crazy, it's Scientology. I mean, you watch Alex Gibney's documentary on Scientology. And look at that whole project and how embarrassing it was. And look at those exit interviews, right? And it's on some level more sophisticated than what we're talking about when you talk about any defense of Christianity.
Yeah. And you guys also talked about AI. And for some reason, I find myself much less scared now than I was earlier this year, simply because I believe the problem is going to be so big that it will get addressed quickly. Where are you on that now? How are you feeling? I mean, I know at some point earlier we were both thinking, how is everybody not talking about this every second of the day? Mm. You still there?
Well, I continue to be impressed about how hard it is to maintain one's concern even when one hasn't found a rational argument that should give you comfort, right? I mean, it is a sort of unique threat. I mean, this was at least the starting point of the talk I gave on it now nearly 10 years ago, that TED talk in 2016, I think. Because it's just, there's something entertaining about it. It's fun to think about the downside. I mean, there's something kind of sexy and interesting about it that is, it's not like a coming plague or, an asteroid impact or something that's just scary and depressing, right? So even if you think the risk is undiminished, I mean, you can't figure out how to be more comfortable with the probabilities or the possible negative outcomes. It's just, there's something very elusive about it. I mean, part of it is that the upside is also very compelling, right? I mean, unlike the threat of nuclear war or anything else, that is any other technological self-imposed risk, I guess synthetic biology is slightly different. It's a little bit more like AI because there's obviously some real upside to our breakthroughs in biology. But I mean, it's just, there's something so, in success, it looks like it could be amazing, leaving aside total unemployment and the social challenge of trying to grapple with that. But yeah, I think it's frankly terrifying when you look at the arms race condition we're in and the people who are the moral quality or lack thereof of the people who are making the decisions for us. I mean, it's like you can count on two hands the number of people totally unregulated by a kleptocratic government at this point, to speak of the United States.
Don't you believe we have to somewhat be unregulated at this point in order to win this arms race?
Well, I just think that if we had a morally sane and competent government, I think we would be forcing some sort of global approach to this global problem, right? I mean, everything would be bent toward that. I'm not talking about stopping development of AI. I don't think that's in the cards under any regime. But clearly, we need to get out of this arms race condition. I mean, we're just merely in an arms race. I mean, that's it. Again, I don't consider myself very close to the behind the scene details here, so I don't know how scary it actually is. But from what people say in public, it should be alarming that the people who are doing this work and the people who are closest to it, when asked, what probability they give to our destroying ourselves with this technology, they all say something terrifying. I mean, they're all like, oh, maybe 20%. You know, I mean, it's just not, it's like you're not hearing people like Sam Altman say, oh, no, we've got this totally in hand and we're being, you know, really safe and scrupulous. And you know, people just have misunderstood this technology. There's no way, there's no self-improving thing on the horizon that could conceivably get away from us. No. Like this has just been way overblown. I would put the risk as, you know, one in a million. Virtually, I mean, maybe Jan LeCun is still somebody who talks that way, but virtually nobody in a position to make decisions says anything like that. So just imagine if all the people developing nuclear technology at the time were saying, okay, we're running a 20% chance of destroying everything, and yet we can't stop. You know, we're doing this as fast as possible. And now you're going to witness a multi-trillion-dollar build out that is going to basically subsume every other economic concern for us and environmental concern. I mean, where did climate change go? You know, you got all these people building the most resource intensive technology anyone ever dreamed of. And, you know, even some of the real climate change focused people like Elon in the past are, you know, there's none of that, right? It's just, you know, we're going to use all the water and all the electricity and let's go.
Well, what's the alternative? Weren't we given a 10% chance for total destruction with nuclear war, with you creating the bomb?
I mean, there was a very small chance that the actual, you know, the Manhattan Project principles thought that we might, I mean, they did some final calculations and put it, I think, at a truly small chance, like one in 10,000 or something. It was not 10%. But they were still placing bets on whether we would ignite the atmosphere and destroy everything.
And that wasn't 10%? I thought that was
10%. No. I mean, they didn't think it was 10% at the time. But imagine if they had. I mean, imagine if they had been willing to pull the trigger at Alamogordo on the Trinity test, thinking there was a 10% chance that they were going to ignite the atmosphere and kill all life on Earth. That would have been irresponsible. That would have been pretty shocking if they had done that. The fact that they thought that any of them thought it was within the realm of possibility is still a little alarming. And that's always been held out as a moment where scientists showed their capacity to whatever the real probabilities were. You can hold that aside. Within their own minds, they showed their capacity to roll the dice with the future of the species in a way that should have kind of shocked everyone. But here, we're in a completely different game. Right. I mean, again, whatever the actual probabilities are aside, there's no way to know that. You have the people who are doing this work, funding this work, making the decisions on a daily basis, the closest to the engineering understanding that should govern one's sense of the probabilities here. They're telling us, yeah, this is we're sort of in coin toss land, you know, or at least dice roll land. You know, a single die may come up, you know, six, and we cancel the future. Right. That's insane. And yet somehow we're not even in a position to have an emotional response to it.
Okay, but what's the alternative? Don't you want Sam Altman or the U.S. to get whatever that is first?
No, I think we do need to navigate this growing, you know, superpower contest with China. We need whatever, you know, economic levers and military levers we can get in hand. But, you know, there should be some possible version of a carrot, which is we figure out how to solve truly global problems jointly, right? I mean, so it's just, we need an American president who could have conceivably unified the world's democracies on this and other points, right? Like all of our European allies and Australia and Canada could be on the same page vis-a-vis Russia and the war in Ukraine, vis-a-vis China and the AI arms race. We need leverage, right? We need to be able to hit the stop button somehow. We need a system of alliances where we can actually credibly threaten China with a plunge back into poverty when we take back all of our supply chain, you know, and we can't just be America, right? We has to be, you know, every other democracy that cares about the fate of civilization. We're not in a political environment where we can collaborate globally in those kinds of ways. And the reason why we're not is, it's not exclusively Trump, but it's, you know, it's Trump to an extraordinary degree. We're not in a position to absorb this kind of shock to our system. You know, it's like you're going to have Tucker Carlson talking about the rise of the machines. Is that really the information diet that half the country? You got to have Joe Rogan and Tucker Carlson chopping it up for 4 hours and making sense of this. We're not ready for the political and economic pivot that will be required in success right? And the in perfect success, with again, without any downside risk. I mean, if all of the catastrophic concerns are pure fiction, the alignment problem was never a problem, and the malicious use of this powerful technology is never significant, right? You don't have cyber terrorism that's AI, you know, weaponized, you know, China doesn't turn out the lights on us, et cetera, right? None of that happens, right? It's all just the good use of this technology, just curing cancer all day long, you know? You know, curing cancer, playing chess, making things. You got AI, you know, Hollywood, Netflix gets to make movies that cost $14 to make, but they're the perfect, you know, wide release summer confections, right? That everyone wants to see because they've been algorithmically tested on a billion brains. And, you know, the next Tom Cruise looks 32 for the rest of his life. And it's all, you know, it's perfect. And yet, where's the economy around all of that? Who edited it? Who shot it? Who, you know, who catered it? None of that happened. It was made for $14 and, you know, on a laptop.
You don't think government intervenes quickly and says, okay, wait, we got to reset?
I mean, it would be amazing if we had the foresight to make the changes politically and economically that we would have to make to spread the wealth around. That would be amazing, right? But I just see nothing in our history or in our in the present that makes it seem like we're capable of doing that, right? I mean, you would need people to be able to agree about the questions of fundamental value, right? Like, what is good for people? What kind of lives do we want to live, right? We can't even agree about the ethics of universal basic income. Like, the moment you raise, I mean, I think there's some question as to whether UBI is the right remedy for a situation like this. And there's certainly debatable points. I think the research on UBI, the actual practical and psychological and social effects of UBI, are that research is somewhat ambiguous still. Although I would point out it's being conducted in a context where these changes haven't been forced on, you know, culture across the board, right? But we can't agree about it. It's like, you know, the moment you mention UBI, you know, half the people will say, you know, this is obviously what we're going to need, some version of this, you know, and it should have no moral stigma attached to it. And then the other half will say, no, this is a catastrophe because people need to work. The people derive their meaning from work, and they should derive their meaning from work. And I can't imagine any other system of norms or expectations where you wouldn't get your meaning from work. And they're, you know, good Christian anchors to a lot of that thinking. If we can't even have that conversation and agree about what we should do, again, under conditions of perfect success, where it's analogous to the creator of the universe just handing us the ultimate labor-saving device right here. Just become as wealthy as you want to be. Here's the hardware and here's the software that cancels the need for human drudgery until the end of the world and will produce every scientific insight of which nature admits is possible, right? Here is an intelligence explosion in your hands. You know, go have at it. In our current condition, we seem totally incapable of absorbing that. You know, that would be the kind of the final irony. It's like, give us the best thing that could ever be invented, and we will turn it into the worst thing that has ever been invented. Right. It's like, you know, the Chinese would nuke us if they knew we had it now, kind of thing. That's how politically combustible we are as a species. Like, if we knew that China had it, right? If China had the AI that could cancel all of our efforts because it's perfect, right? And it's perfectly aligned to their use, right? Like, it's not going to get away from them, but they can decide to just enjoy a winner take all spoils situation. They've got their first and they've proven it. What would we do? Given the level of antagonism in our world, given how zero sum we are, what would we do? I mean, would we just bomb them? I think I would put the chances at 50-50, right? I mean, we're so far from even having a conversation about how to have a global civilization that works, because, I mean, and this again, that I this comes back to our own domestic politics and how it is so much worse than the alternatives. I mean, say what you want about Biden and what could have been true under, you know, a Kamala Harris presidency. Lots of awful things I could also whinge about. But the one thing we wouldn't have is this plunge into America first, know-nothingism, this retreat from the world, the sense that even our allies are contemptible, right? I mean, we don't even like our allies, you know, and we sort of like our enemies. If we can get our enemies to pay up, we kind of like them more than our allies because they have our ethics, you know. It's like we don't want to hold ourselves to any standard of decency globally. So we actually are more comfortable doing deals with other countries that don't hold them to themselves to any standard of decency, right? Like, yes, of course, we can do a deal with the UAE or Qatar, or, you know, it's just bakshish, right? I mean, like, so that change, the stepping back from alliances and imagining that we can go it alone on some level, and the fact that half of our society is celebrating that and is just trying to figure out, you know, whether they can suffer the Jews in their midst as they become more and more selfish and more oblivious to what's happening in the rest of the world. I mean, that is far worse than the alternative, right? I mean, again, Kamala Harris was not a good candidate. The wokeness is as terrible as everyone on the right has said it is. I would never minimize any of that. But we would have continued being a country that is looking to solve global problems in a sane way under President Harris. There's no question about that.
Well, we know you'll have job security because you're going to have to help us think through all this continually on the podcast. And then
maybe
on the other side, you're going to have to help us figure out what to do with all this time with the meditation app. So let's shift gears now to Tucker and his demons.
You're determined to keep me in a good mood.
Yeah, no, I just saw, I think this is kind of funny. I saw him tell this story. I know he's told it before about him being clawed by demons while asleep in bed with his wife and four dogs. And again, this was accepted by so many as, I guess, fact is this could happen. And there were four dogs in that bed. What's happening here?
Who knows? It's incredible. We, you know, half of the culture, at least half, receives that story in a very different way. I mean, you know, I hear him tell that story, and I've heard it at least in two contexts. I think I heard it on it's on somebody else's podcast, and I think he was on stage with Megyn Kelly or somebody. He told it, and it was to my ear. I mean, the next question is, how does this guy have an audience? How does he maintain his audience telling this story? I mean, it's an SNL sketch, right? I mean, like, he can't figure out how he got those scratches with, he's got four dogs in the bed. Four? I mean, like, two would have been a punchline, but no, he's got four dogs in the bed. And yet, demonology is the only possible explanation for this.
I had this funny take where I sort of imagined Tucker sitting around with his buddies, seeing what they could get away with. And, you know, he could just tell stories sort of like Trump saying he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and no one would care. But Trump just saying, but Tucker saying, no, man, I'm going to tell this story. And his buddies are like, four dogs in the bed. He's like, yeah, fine. Yeah. Fine. I can still watch this. Four dogs, no one's going to say a thing.
Well, it's just anyone who's for whom it lands the way it landed for me is likely out of touch with this culture. But when you're looking at the culture he's considering when he tells any story, it is an entirely a religious one. And we're talking about a culture that has been so steeped in prophecy and conspiracy thinking and biblical, you know, certainty. This land, it lands in a totally different, actually, this is something I learned from Ross in my conversation with Ross Douthat that I genuinely didn't know this. I mean, if I ever knew it, I'd certainly forgotten it. That in Tucker's mind, almost certainly being attacked by a demon, should that have actually been, you know, the way he really did view it and certainly the way his audience viewed it, there's something self-aggrandizing about that story, right? I mean, the only reason why a demon would attack you is the perception that your work is so important, right? You know, you're doing the work of God so effectively that, you know, that you've now attracted the attention of, you know, Satan himself and his retinue, and, you know, they're pulling out all the stops to thwart your very important work, right? That's the subtext to that story, right? And that I completely missed. I thought, okay, here's a guy who's just showing us how crazy and gullible he is and how crazy and gullible he thinks his audience is. You know, his mind has become one of those crappy broadsheets that you used to see next to the cash register in a supermarket, right? The News of the World or whatever that was, you know, next to the National Enquirer, where, like, you know, the Bat Boy and the alien craft, you know, was found, and the Roswell bodies were recovered, etc. I mean, that's his mind, and he's happy to show that mind to his audience, but it's because it works for him. I mean, everyone who believes that about him thinks this is, he just won the Nobel Prize for spiritual importance in that audience.
But I would totally understand that claim if he woke up with these claw marks and he was in bed by himself. When you add right. the dogs, everyone should say, wait, Tucker. No, you had four dogs in bed with you.
But that shows the invisible agency of the demonic, right? The dogs didn't even wake up, I guess, right? It's like he could be attacked and even his four dogs were none the wiser. That's what we're dealing with here, right? I mean, this is just, it's a totally moronic fact about us that we even have to talk about this. But the reason why this is not just funny is that Tucker could run for president, right? He could credibly run for president in as early as 2028, right? I mean, this is not peripheral to our political concerns that tens of millions of people find this guy an important voice of insight, right? And Tucker's telling us, and Joe Rogan too. You know, all these guys who interviewed Tucker, the All In podcast guys and Rogan, and they treat him like he's a totally sane representative of real journalism, right? Like the mainstream media has failed. All those institutions have embarrassed themselves. They're totally lacking in credibility because of how wrong they got COVID. I guess that's the punchline for most of these people. And so, no, the real journalism is coming from people like Tucker. And so half of our society is stuck with that kind of, obviously the crazy religious ultra red-pilled part of the right is there, but also Joe Rogan's audience is there. The All In podcast audience is there. I mean, if you saw how these guys conducted their conversations with Tucker, there was no daylight between them and this total crackpot. So it's scary. I mean, it does not bode well for our politics in the next few years.
Yeah, well, on this subject, how are you feeling about this fracturing on the right? Seems we have Ben Shapiro, Erica Kirk, Mark Levin on one side, and you got Candace and Nick Fuentes and Tucker, and I guess maybe even Megan at this point, and Kelly on the other. Where does this go?
Well, again, it's alarming because, I mean, just look at what was demonstrated at the Turning Point conference, right? I mean, here you've got this is the certainly in the aftermath of Kirk's assassination, then the most important meeting out there in the real world for Republicans now was this America Fest conference. I think it was like 30,000 people attended, something like that. This is where all the energy is in the Republican Party. This is where all the political momentum is and the concern around votes. And here you've got a group of people who are so enamored of conspiracy thinking that when someone shows up telling them that they had their own founder murdered, right? This is, basically Tucker Carlson's, the space he's protecting for Candace Owens' conspiracy thinking, right? Candace is going on and on about how they had, Turning Point had Kirk murdered. I think there's even something about, Erica Kirk being implicated in this or having an affair with J.D. Vance. I mean, I don't listen to Candace, but I just hear the echoes of her madness.
And always a pinch of Jews in there too. It's always there.
Oh yeah, I mean, yes, all of this ends in Auschwitz, you can be sure of it. And I'll come back to that because I'm not actually, it's not as hyperbolic as it sounds. But you have one of the most, it's insane to say this, but one of the most influential broadcasters, right of center, Candace Owens, claiming ad nauseum that Turning Point had its patron saint and founder assassinated. And Tucker is resisting Tucker and also Megyn Kelly and, again, the leading lights of conservative broadcasting are protecting that space for her, not wanting to exile her, not wanting to even criticize her, really, because they're so concerned about the importance of her audience and they're so enamored of conspiracy thinking themselves. And you force this allegation into the citadel of Turning Point itself, the first conference they're having after the murder of their founder. You say, you evil people had your founder killed, and half the room wants to hear more, right? Half the room applauds, right? They're down for it. That's how much they love conspiracy thinking, right? That's how crazy this culture is. You're pointing the finger of accusation at them saying, you murdered him. With the Jews, with Israel, with the French Foreign Legion, whatever the fucking theory is.
But isn't Turning Point also guilty of doing the same thing? Why don't they stand up, you know, Eric could come out and say, hey, if you're going to have that, you gotta leave.
That's my point. Turning Point itself is saying, tell us more. Like the people who paid for those tickets, the people who are part of the organization, the people who showed up, the Jack Posobiec's on the stage who will just both sides it and say, you know, it's Ben Shapiro says one thing, but then you got Tucker and Candace saying the other thing. The other thing is you had Charlie Kirk assassinated, you evil bastards, right? And they've got time for it, right? That's how fucking crazy this culture has become, to say nothing of the fact that they have time for Nick Fuentes, you know? So Tucker gives Nick Fuentes the platform of all platforms, ushers him into the mainstream of the Republican Party, you know, an avowed anti-Semite, an avowed incel hater of women, an avowed fan of Hitler and Stalin, and someone who's also, you know, against interracial marriage and castigating the vice president for his, you know, having married an Indian woman. And even the vice president, even J.D. Vance, can't say anything critical of Nick Fuentes, apart from saying that anyone who, you know, comes after my wife can fuck off, right? It's just, it's the slur against his wife.
Yeah, keep it on the Jews.
He could barely find the courage to disavow that. So important is it to keep these anti-Semites and white supremacists and moral lunatics in the tent, right? No enemies to the right is so much the master algorithm that he can barely say anything against Fuentes in defense of his own wife, right, and his biracial children. But needless to say, he can't say anything. There's nothing wrong with ushering in a fan of Hitler and Stalin into the big tent of the MAGA party. No, because we need those guys. We need the fans of Stalin and the fans of Hitler and the just asking questions people, you know, the people who don't know whether the Holocaust happened, but if it did, they wouldn't be so sure it was a bad thing. We need to keep our powder dry, you know, and collaborate with all of these people. This also falls to Trump. You know, whatever you think about how stalwart he's been in defending Israel or defending Jews, you know, Trump was the guy who, you know, had to pretend he didn't know who David Duke was when asked how, you know, what he thought about David Duke and his supporters loving Trump, right? You know, cue the footage of him knowing exactly who David Duke was, you know, several years before, you know, that was found.
Yeah, pass the mashed potatoes,
yeah, exactly.
David.
I mean, it's a fever swamp over there on the right, and it's very dangerous.
I want to go back to the Auschwitz comment in a second, but what would you like to see happen? Is it better that they unite and everyone makes nice and they're all good and aligned, or is it that they fracture and do you fear something worse happens if the Ben side goes one way and Tucker ascends to power?
Well, I fear that, I mean, it is truly alarming that it is proving difficult to disavow Nazism and anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial among mainstream Republicans, right? I mean, and by mainstream, I mean like the vice president of the United States, right? The fact that the vice president has to, when asked, so are you in, what do you think about Nick Fuentes? He has to mince his words so finely as to say nothing of value apart from, I don't like him talking about my wife like that, right? I mean, like that's the one spot he felt like as a man he had to occupy. But I mean, this is the Republican Party. This is the current Republican Party, right? This is the most plausible candidate for the presidency on the Republican side in 2028. The current vice president is someone who's clearly happy to play nice with Hitler and Stalin lovers at this point. But we have a president who, you know, is friendlier with Putin, arguably, than any other, you know, world leader, you know, or if it's not Putin, it's MBS. I mean, none of this is recognizable to me. I mean, all of this existed for as long as we've been alive in incipient form on the right, but it was disavowed by the people who were the real conservatives. You know, they were, you know, I mean, it was people like, you know, Bill Buckley who built a firewall against all this awfulness. But that firewall no longer exists, and, you know, or most of the political energy is on the other side of it, right? So Ben Shapiro, I mean, it's a lonely job, right? Who's standing with him? And it's very ominous that the variable around which this battle is pitched seems to be, you know, Israel and the Jews, right? And it's the Jews lining up on one side, right? You got Ben and Barry seeing what's wrong with Nick Fuentes, right? But you got Megan and, you know, and Tucker and Candace to various degrees saying, well, we...
And just to be clear, those are different. Those people are different. Megan's not saying the things she's...
They're different. So like, so Megan, the blandest version of it is, you know, it's not my cup of tea. Nick Fuentes isn't my cup of tea. I wouldn't interview him, but I'm not going to criticize anyone who signal boosted him without any pushback. Like, I'm not going to criticize Tucker. And I'm not even going to criticize Candace, who's just, you know, I mean, Tucker and Candace are, you know, probably the biggest propagators of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories on Earth right now, right? And just to look at what Tucker did to signal boost Fuentes, I mean, that's just, you know, he's got to be in first position. There's a lot to say. There should be a lot that Megan could say against that, right? How the mainstream Republican Party can't break its alliance to people like Tucker and Candace, I mean, that the fact that it can't should be alarming to everyone. Again, it's totally unhinged. There are a lot of things that can be debated about the future of, you know, liberalism and democracy. And I mean, you know, there's this sort of, you know, post-liberal moment that's happening on the right that has, you know, some kind of intellectual core to it. I mean, it's something that I think is also troubling, but maybe there's a good faith debate to be had about a lot of that that could still be within, you know, within the any sane Overton window among Republicans now. But I mean, we're talking about fans, avowed fans of Hitler and Stalin. That's what they can't figure out how to regurgitate at this moment.
And so you're talking about that on the right being something new. There's also something scary emerging on the left with regard to anti-Semitism.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's just, it's not holding power, right? I mean, it is scary. And I mean, you know, the fact that someone like, you know, Mamdani has to dance around his past and perhaps present alliance with, you know, obvious anti-Semites in, you know, on the far left, and, you know, the Democratic Socialists and the Islamists. And I mean, it's just, yeah, I mean, there's a ton of anti-Semitism there that should be troubling. But here we're talking about people who hold the levers of power, or the ear of those who hold the levers of power in America at this moment.
Right. I think plus on the left, they try to make the distinction whether they know it or not, but they're trying to call out Israel and be very careful to support Jews and separate the two. But I think oftentimes when you're criticizing Israel, you know, you could find yourself in an anti-Semitic.
I mean, the Muslims don't do that. I mean, we should point out that the Muslims never do that, right? I mean, in Arabic, it's always just the Jews, right? I mean, this is not the Palestinians. There's no one on the Palestinian side who's, you know, who wants to globalize the Intifada, or, you know, who thinks there was a genocide in Gaza. You know, there's no one within the actual community of Palestinians who's talking about anything other than the Jews, right? They're not talking about Zionists. They're not talking about the state of Israel. They're talking about the Jews did this, the Jews did that. Let's get rid of the Jews. That's what happens in Arabic, right? So the fact that there's this seemingly shades of nuance that people are capable of on the left as they try to collaborate with genuine Islamists, but most of that's just a moral hallucination, right? I mean, it is just hatred of the Jews and an unwillingness to live alongside them that is animating most of the talk on, you know, in Gaza and about Gaza. And that's what Israel, I mean, that's why it's just not a solvable situation, right? There is no two-state solution to be had with all that.
Right. Well, related to that, any thoughts on the Bondi Beach massacre, and does anything change for you?
Man, it just gets rosier and rosier here.
Well, I got to get through some of this. Does it change for you that there was a Muslim man was a total hero?
Yeah, that was awesome.
In helping, saving many lives. Does that complicate things for you, or you're able to just kind of hold those two thoughts separately?
Not at all. I mean, that's fantastic and well worth celebrating. And yeah, we need a billion more people like that who have that attitude toward jihadism, right? I mean, the end game here is that the Muslim world has to disavow and root out jihadism. They have to recognize that the jihadists are their own Nazis, right? They've got their Nazi problem. Like, whatever, it's like the West, if it's on the West to figure out what to do with Nazism, it's on the Muslim world to figure out what to do with jihadism, right? And there's precious little evidence that 2 billion Muslims are ready for that project, right? That they want anything to do with it. But to see one put his life on the line like that, I mean, that's, again, we need a billion people with that attitude. I mean, that was fantastic.
All right, switching gears. Do you want to address the fact that they found one of your pictures in the Epstein files? No, I'm just kidding. I just want to see the audience have a heart attack.
I mean, I guess it's possible.
I wanted them to go,
anything's
wait, what?
Possible. Yeah. Certainly with AI, it's really anything's possible.
Anything new to discuss on that topic, or are we just bored to death of it? Anything?
No, well, it's the more this cover-up, I mean, it looks like a cover-up. I mean, the more ineptitude we see from, you know, Pam Bondi and everyone attached to this kind of rolling out of heavily redacted information, the more it seems like there is a there. You know, as you know, I'm basically allergic to conspiracy theories and will be dragged kicking and screaming to each last one. But I'm being dragged to this one because, I mean, why would you do it this way if there wasn't stuff to hide? Like releasing things that are this heavily redacted and doing it under this kind of duress and lying about stuff that's so obviously disconfirmable. I mean, just, you know, Trump says he was never on his plane and all of a sudden he's on his plane, you know, a dozen times or whatever it was. I mean, it's just...
And then there's a picture of him somewhere and then it's removed quickly because you can see him in the background.
Yeah, I'm not following it because, again, I imagine I have better things to do. But insofar as I've seen it kind of leak out into my algorithmic news diet, it just looks like there's got to be something to hide. If you're willing to absorb this much pain for doing it this badly on the it's really, because what's unique about this is that this is the one thing apparently that the MAGA base cares about that puts them at cross purposes with Trump. Right, like they care about this release, and the release is being so just botched in ways that you didn't even know you could botch it. I mean, from the first moment, like to release with great fanfare, you know, inviting all these grifters and lunatics to the White House to take delivery of binders that contained nothing but stuff that had been already released, right? And it is anodyne stuff.
Like coupons.
Yeah, right. Exactly, like CVS coupons. I mean, it's just like, what, how? I mean, it's just, I don't know. So maybe there is a there, you know? I mean, maybe, I'm starting to get interested. That's all I can say.
Maybe Trump is actually playing 4D chess here and it's an elaborate distraction so that every time he, you know, there's just nothing there, but every time he's doing something he shouldn't be doing, he just leaks a little bit more, screws this release up.
It's not
more to get people talking about it.
I mean, I don't know. I think
probably
he is,
not.
From what I've seen, it does look like he's genuinely frustrated that this can't be made to go away. And you're just seeing real incompetence. I mean, there's nothing strategic about, I mean, the effect. It's very hard to see how the effect of any of these releases is what they would have hoped for. So, you know, there's no method to this madness.
And no part of you believes he's just doing his best to protect President Clinton.
Yeah, protect all the Democrats who will be implicated. No part of me believes that. Although I think it is probably true that an equal number of Democrats will be implicated, right? I think this is an equal opportunity embarrassment. So, yeah. So, I mean, that goes without saying.
No, get your popcorn. All right, switching gears. And speaking of popcorn, I saw a clip from a recent episode of Rogan's podcast with Brett Weinstein on it, and they were essentially claiming that you had blood on your hands for advocating for the vaccine.
Yeah.
Now, I know at one point, Brett had cited a study claiming that the vaccine had killed 17 million people worldwide, and I don't know if he still believes that.
I think he still stands by that, yeah.
Yeah, but how is it possible that something like this, you know, where there should be facts, I mean, what are we, 5 years later? We should know this 4 or 5 years in. How can this be debated? How can somebody really think that 17 million people died and you think that didn't happen?
Yeah, so I saw that clip or clips. Somebody sent me the kind of a reel. So I don't think I'm seeing stuff out of necessary context. I mean, this was like, you know, 17 minutes or so worth of clips of their discussion of me and vaccines. And all I can say is that, I mean, they're both, I mean, they're differently culpable because, I mean, at least, you know, I mean, Brett's got a graduate degree in biology. So it's I guess, is less defensible, his ignorance on this point. But I mean, they're both obviously in an information bubble, right? And I get that it's It might be hard for Joe to detect that because the bubble is to such a unique degree of his own making. I mean, it really is the bubble of his, you know, thousands of episodes of his podcast that, and the influence of having an audience that size. And he's surrounded by people who believe the same things and who are thinking in similar ways. And the amount of confirmation bias, and I mean, it's literally not too much to say that he not only got Trump elected, he got RFK Jr. put in charge of our health establishment, right? I mean, it's like, would either of those things have happened without those appearances on Rogan's podcast? I'm not sure, right? I mean, at least it seems like a coin toss as to whether or not you could credit him with both of those outcomes. So that's he's in that world. I mean, he's in the RFK Jr. world of information, right? Where it's like you can have a two-hour conversation about vaccines and Wi-Fi and other craziness, and this is just real information, right? You know, COVID was basically nothing. It was just like a plandemic. Just the Soros-funded liberal elites were just trying to exert control over our society, and they used this common flu as a pretext. But the pharmaceutical industries are so sinister that they developed a weaponized piece of biotech that has killed 17 million people. And
I don't think Rogan's making that claim.
No, but he's talking to somebody who does, and there's no daylight between him and Weinstein, right? I mean, it's like these are the real purveyors of information. Like, you're talking to people who have their heads screwed on straight when you're talking to Brett Weinstein and RFK Jr., and I'm somebody who's lost to the utterly corrupt kind of mainstream narrative that got everything wrong, right? Like the Sanjay Guptas of the world and the Anthony Faucis of the world, they'd lied to us about everything. And, you know, the mainstream is stuck there. COVID was basically a non-event to which we overreacted. These vaccines are really dangerous. And everyone knows somebody who was killed outright or grievously harmed by the vaccine. I mean, doesn't everyone know that person? Isn't that more or less what Joe said in that podcast? The thing that I can't help but appreciate and marvel over and worry about is the degree to which our culture has been shattered by algorithmically boosted misinformation. And Joe has had more than a front row seat to that. His podcast has been one of the more important stages on which that amplification of misinformation has taken place, right? But he's a victim of it as well as a author of it. And so I don't even know how to interact with this at this point. Personally, I wish him nothing but happiness, right? Like, he's a former friend. It's hard to say that he's a current friend. We have no contact. I mean, I've reached out to him privately to try to talk some sense into him, and he hasn't responded. So that I take that as, you know, his decision that we're no longer friends, because I certainly reached out in friendship.
Or maybe he just doesn't want to talk about this topic anymore if you reached out and...
But that's not how a friend would respond to not respond, right? I mean, it's like, what I did point out to him, and I would point out to any of our listeners, is if you take any of the claims that Joe and Brett made about vaccines in that podcast and put them into any LLM, what you immediately get back is all the reasons why they're completely wrong, right? So what does that mean? Does that mean that all the LLMs have been corrupted by the lamestream media and the pharmaceutical companies, and that really the totality of our knowledge about the real effect of vaccines now exists in the worm-eaten brain of RFK Jr. and his friends? I mean, like, what are we talking about here? What's the conspiracy theory that's going to explain what the LLMs tell us about vaccine safety and the numbers of people who were not killed by the COVID vaccine and who were killed by COVID? And what was the actual cost of vaccine hesitancy in the United States? You know, I mean, like, how many people died because they didn't get vaccinated when they could have been vaccinated? And what was the different expression of mortality among Democrats and Republicans once the vaccines became available? And what explains why the U.S., which was the first to get access to the vaccine, nevertheless did worse, all things considered, than most other democratic developed nations under COVID? There are answers to these questions. We're not mystified by all of it. And all the answers that Joe seems to have in his head are wrong. So I how do you interact with that? I mean, it's just, I lobbed some information his way and it's radio silence. So, I mean, there's nothing to do.
Well, maybe this is something else AI will solve. in time when it stops hallucinating and gets all the answers right, which hopefully will be soon, because...
I mean, the concern is that there'll be some way to maintain the shattering of our information landscape and, you know, weaponize AI to that end, right? I mean, that's also possible. But currently, it seems to me, at least on this point, you know, I mean, I didn't use a bunch of models, but I checked the two main ones at the moment, ChatGPT and Gemini. I mean, I guess I could have gone to Claude too.
But even Grok would have given you this answer.
Yeah, but I mean, I think Grok is still capable of giving some weird answers. But yeah, I mean, I would expect Grok would be fine.
You think Grok would tell you that 17 million people were killed?
No, I mean, we can easily check. No, I don't think that. But no, but even like Brett had some cockamamie idea about how it made sense. He had some story that people who took the vaccine had higher mortality when infected with COVID because the vaccines can distract your immune system from the natural pathogen by introducing this antigen into the body or causing the body cells to produce the antigen itself. You're distracting your otherwise robust immune system from doing its natural work. I mean, the other thing is there's this comical notion of what's natural that does a lot of work for these guys. I mean, so like Joe's got this idea that just by being in really good shape and eating well and eating, you know, wild caught game and lifting a lot of weights and taking vitamins and everything else he's doing, this is the only thing you really need in the face of a pandemic. And this is his echo chamber now subsumes the federal government. Right, because now we got Jay Bhattacharya up there prognosticating about what we should do in the face of the next, you know, inevitable pandemic, and it is to get in good shape and boost our immune system. And it's like Joe Rogan wrote the brief that Bhattacharya is putting out there as, you know, government health advice. Right now, there's nothing wrong with being in shape and eating well. Obviously, that is something we want to do. But
until the next pandemic targets fit people,
the idea that you know. That should be a complete scientific message about how the United States will position itself to respond to the next pandemic is madness, right? It's just, you know, so this whole Maha cult of kind of do it yourself prepping, you know, do your own research and do your own epidemiology and, well, I guess it's a quasi-religious impulse, right? It's like it's one of these spaces that got invaded maybe when religion retreated, but I guess a lot of these people are also religious. I don't know. It is just a symptom of the fragmentation of our information landscape that to which we, you know, well, I guess we can attribute almost every social ill at this point. It is the substance of our reaction to everything and our failure to coordinate on every important problem. I mean, I agree that this is actually, you know, this supersedes most other problems. I mean, I think our inability to figure out what's real is our most important problem at this point, politically and socially. And so that's why conspiracy thinking is so noxious, right? I mean, and so worth condemning in general. It's not to say that there's no conspiracies ever that are, you know, that will surprise us in turning out to be real, but it's just this appetite for the conspiratorial is structuring so much of our engagement with information now. I mean, it's driving us crazy. Right. I mean, this is the way we're being driven crazy by our technology.
Well, if we can't do it already, we'll be able to do it soon. Probably take all of your episodes, take Rogan's episodes, take Brett's, throw them into ChatGPT.
Oh, yeah, we can do that
and
now.
And ask
sure.
it to tell us what you got right, what they got right, and give us a verdict.
We need to get a version that's a little less sycophantic than, I mean, you can actually change the settings. And
I love all you guys.
And strip out, yeah. But it will sort of matter whose account you use. It shouldn't matter whose account you use, but the sycophantic nature of the default settings can play a little havoc, I would still assume. But
I just find it interesting because we know Brett and he's super bright. He's very nice. I think he fully believes everything he's saying and how it's possible that he's convicted around his information and we're sitting here looking at different information in our bubble.
I mean, this is the thing that it is disorienting because I mean, even leave Brett aside, man. I agree. Brett is super nice. And
he said the same about you.
It's not easy for me to see how he's taken in by what he's saying, but it's very easy to see how Joe and a wide audience would be taken in by what he's saying because he just radiates sobriety and circumspection as he tiptoes toward the lunacy, the full lunacy of whatever topic he's touching. It's not just COVID. I mean, he's touched a bunch of topics where he just lands in just the most florid conspiratorial style of thinking, right? The way he's, you know, connecting the pinpoints on the map with red string, you know, I mean, he's doing it in the most sober and careful and cautious and seemingly self-critical way.
Yeah, but some of the smartest people I know, you know, believe in religion or God, and maybe what he's doing is behind that same door. Maybe there's some...
Oh yeah, so there's that style of thinking that is, again, you have to look at how the rules have changed on this one topic, how you're not actually being coherent. You're not actually holding yourself to the standard you would hold somebody else to. I mean, again, it's Tucker with his four fucking dogs, and he still thinks there's a demon in bed with him, right? I mean, Jesus Christ. But even looking at someone like Candace, right? I mean, Candace, who is just, I mean, she's, what she's saying is totally crazy and totally, I mean, it's just the most cynical style of grifting. I mean, it's just, it's so odious and unprincipled, and yet, to watch her do it, again, I haven't logged a lot of hours, but, you know, I've logged some minutes doing this. You know, I've probably seen an hour of her in her recent incarnation. There's something so compelling about how she does it. I mean, she's so good as a broadcaster.
Oh, yeah.
Doing this. I mean, just, it's impossible to detect that she's crazy, apart from the fact that what she's saying is crazy, or that she's lying, apart from the fact that what she's saying is obviously untrue. And I'm hard-pressed to come up with a third alternative, right? So she's just, what she's saying is sanity straining, and yet the way she says it is so compelling and in its own way balanced, right? Like she's not agitated in a way that discredits her, right? Like if she were really, you know, fulminating in a way that made her seem, you know, emotionally unbalanced or, you know, she's being blown around by, you know, impulses she can't control. So, okay, look, now I see she's been destabilized. I mean, a lot of people are interpreting her as, you know, in the midst of some kind of psychiatric event, right, given what she's saying. But, I mean, obviously, I'm not a clinician. I don't know what I'm looking for. But when I watch her go on these riffs, the content is psychotic, yes. But the source is, it's just performance art. Explain what she's doing.
She definitely presents as someone who's exasperated, who's just had enough and needs to, I'm just going to tell you the truth now. I can't hold back anymore. And so that's a very believable position at times. I mean,
yeah, I mean, she's got no fucks left to give,
right?
And she'll torch anything.
Right.
You know, this guy used to be a friend. He's not a friend any longer. So here goes. But what she's saying is crazy.
Yeah.
So,
well, the latest one I saw was she told black people that their fight was not with the white man, it was with the Jews because they were right behind the slavery.
Yeah.
As though.
Yeah. Now, there's no question. I have no doubt that she's found something online that seems to justify that claim, right? I'm sure there was some Jewish cotton magnate who, you know, she can lay all of the slave trade on, right? But like it's not like there's no meme that you can produce. This is what's so insidious about conspiracy thinking, right? It's like, it's not just pure fiction. There's the example you can spin up into a whole kind of rival universe of stories. There was the camera that was not recording at the time that Epstein supposedly killed himself. How do you explain that, right? I mean, so like, there's always something that you can seize on, some anomaly. So I'm sure she's got it for every one of the things she's said, you know, including that Brigitte Macron as a man. And I mean, it's like, it's just, but it's the general shape of everything she's covering is so poisonous in its social implications and so crazy in the way she's doing the math. But again, it's the same thing with RFK Jr. Like this is not, he's not categorically different. He's impressively similar to her, in fact. It's just a different topic.
Yeah. I mean, I find hers to be much more dangerous to a certain subset of the population than his.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is that, but it's just, that comes back to my claim about, you know, all these conspiracies end in Auschwitz. I mean, it's an unhappy fact that anti-Semitism really is the kind of the most ancient and most attractive, most captivating conspiracy theory. And it's the one to which so many of them return on some level, right? You keep asking, if you're just asking questions about X, you know, and you're just asking questions about why, eventually you're going to be just asking questions about the Holocaust or about what the Jews did to produce every harm you care about.
All right. Well, it's that time again. I think we need to move to the lightning round, Sam.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's keep these a little shorter.
All right.
Let's move through these.
I'll do it. I can do it.
There's not too many of them. I think you can do it.
This is my New Year's resolution, to be able to do a lightning round.
Rapid fire these at me. What 2025 making sense conversation or conversations influenced you the most? Or do you have any favorite moments off the top of your head?
No, I have no favorite moments off the top of my head.
Nothing comes to mind? All right.
I enjoyed many of them. I regret how many had to be political, but it really did seem necessary at the time. And I think unfortunately, it will still be necessary. I mean, politics is just the opportunity cost that I got to embrace.
Do you have any thoughts on how Hollywood and Madison Avenue spent years or a handful of years telling us that being overweight was sexy and healthy and putting many plus size models in ads only to see them all sort of go on GLP-1s the second they became available, and that story is just gone?
Yeah. Well, here I'm going to agree with Joe Rogan entirely, I think. I mean, it was always ridiculous to claim that being obese was just a kind of an alternative way of being healthy and happy and totally functional. I mean, that just was never true. And now more people know it.
You sent me an episode of Fareed Zakaria's podcast on tariffs. I hadn't had a chance to listen to it. What were the takeaways that you can share? What did you find interesting there?
Oh, he just in a very patient and comprehensive way showed over the course of an hour how the jury is no longer out on tariffs and has not been out for quite some time. We know tariffs are, all things considered, bad for the economy, and there's no good reason to do them in this way, except if you are corrupt and you want to practice patronage because you, the president, become a bottleneck where everyone has to, you know, in a bespoke way, negotiate their own relief from the tariff that you've arbitrarily imposed on them. And so it just becomes a way of exerting political power and using the levers of U.S. trade policy to personally enrich your family and the families of your collaborators. So it's a deeply corrupt thing that Trump is doing, and it's obvious, and it should be obvious to everyone, and it should be unacceptable. But he just goes through historically how we've learned the lesson of tariffs, you know, all the way back after the Depression, even before, I think it goes back to the late 19th century. And it's just, this is not how we got wealthier and wealthier over the last 100 years, by tariffing allies and enemies to the limit of endurance. That was not the strategy.
Is there a moment where he steelmans him to try to best understand what's happening, or there's just no—
Not that I recall.
Understanding.
Not that, I mean, it's just so obviously stupid and corrupt that it's, I mean, what you can do is in a selective way, in a very narrow way, you can tariff something that is uniquely disadvantaging one sector of the economy, you know, for some brief period as a way of resetting things, right? You can use this as a point of leverage on one thing and a point of relief in one sector. But this comprehensive tariffing of everything in all directions is just bonkers. But it gives him the ability to practice a kind of crony capitalism and, you know, a patronage regime that is, again, there's nothing secret about this. It's all in plain view, just how wealthy he's getting doing this.
Thoughts on Trump's post about the murder of Rob and Michelle Reiner? Is this the bottom, or does it go further from here?
God damn, this is, man, these topics are brutal. I mean, that was a moment where I think the scales fell from at least a few pairs of eyes, right? I mean, some people saw that as a new low that they didn't think even Trump would be capable of. I mean, the truth is, I was briefly but noticeably shocked by that post. I guess I was shocked because it was a new low for Trump, I thought. But what was shocking was that it was evidence of his perception that his audience would like it, right? Like that he does not pay a price. I mean, this is always the thing that blows my mind, is that it's not the thing that he says or does. It's the knowledge that we live in a country where something like half the people are going to admire that thing he just said or did, right? Like the fact that he is right to understand that there's no downside for him. That's the thing that dropped my jaw.
Well, then he's right for redeeming himself with those presidential plaques.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So, that's just pure comedy. I mean, I at least there, I understand how some people, I mean, the people who don't see the downside, they don't see how this is degrading our institutions and kind of harming our reputation as a country in some kind of durable way. I mean, like, I don't know how we quite ever fully resurrect our reputation, given these what's going to happen in the next 3 years, but what's already happened this year. But I mean, so it has diminished us as a country. There's no question. Like the fact that you go on the official White House website and you see essentially the equivalent of, if not the actual poop emoji, right? Like, I mean, that's basically the vibe we're communicating to the rest of the civilized world. But at least there, I see, if you're not in touch with the importance of maintaining some kind of decorum on the world stage, I can see how you think it's funny, right? I mean, it's like there is a laugh to be had around all that, you know, that the portrait of Biden is just an auto pen. I mean, I understand how internet trolls and troll culture are having fun with that. The Rob Reiner thing, I just do not get how someone didn't just achieve a new level of surprise in the negative direction around Trump. If there were people who read that and thought, he's better than I thought he was, like there was a positively valent surprise, I'm amazed if those people exist.
I just think the equivalent, if somebody at that level would have said something remotely similar about Charlie Kirk, you know, a day or two after, would have made a post like that.
Yeah. I mean, just imagine President Kamala Harris, her official communication after the murder of Charlie Kirk is he obviously got what was coming to him because he wasn't woke enough or
right.
You
can't even imagine it. It sounds stupid coming out of your mouth.
Like just what, but no, it wouldn't even be that. That's not even petty enough. I mean, it's not politically awful enough because Trump's point was that he hadn't, you know, he had TDS, right? So like he got this because he'd driven so many people crazy with how much he hated me, right? It was all about me, Trump, right? So Kamala Harris would have had to have bent it all to her vanity somehow. The fact that it's literally unthinkable, even for Kamala Harris's worst critics, should tell you something, but it tells them nothing. Someday we will wake up and be properly mortified that we've spent the last decade this way as a country. And I got to think that mortification will be shared to some portion of people right of center, but man, it's going to be, it'll be a moment.
All right, my last question for you. Favorite movie or show you're currently watching or recently watched? Give us a quick list of what we should check out.
You know, I hadn't watched Eddington until this week. It got enough bad press that I thought, maybe the movie totally misfired. I really thought it was amazingly funny and well-written. I mean, some of the performances are fantastic. I mean, Joaquin Phoenix is fantastic, but it is so well, some of it is so well written. I mean, some of the dialogue, I mean, it's hard to achieve what he did because he's basically writing incredibly smart dialogue for stupid people. And some of it's really brilliant. And I was quite surprised because it got like a bunch of bad press, at least that I saw. I laughed quite loudly watching this movie.
This reminds me of the incredibly bright words coming out of stupid people's mouths of the story you told me about you and Joseph Goldstein asking ChatGPT and having a valley girl give you crazy deep answers. What was that?
Yeah. So we didn't talk about this on the podcast. Oh, so
I don't think so.
Joseph and I fell into one of our age-old debates now about kind of the subtleties of meditation and the differences between Vipassana and Dzogchen and duality and non-duality. And, you know, we were getting frustrated, and one of us had the idea to have ChatGPT referee the debate, and we flipped on the voice version of it, which I never use. I mean, I'm still kind of text-based, so I didn't know it would come on. My default was a woman's voice that was like it was just so
vocal
obviously
fry.
Like a Gen Z dummy voice, right? I mean, it was just like deliberately not smart sounding, but she was effectively omniscient for this topic. I mean, it was just so good on this topic. It was like having every Buddhist scholar in the world just sitting in the room with you, prepared to judge the merits of each side of this debate. And yet the delivery was, I mean, it wasn't Valley Girl, but it was just like, it was just Gen Z vocal fry, you know, just like the intern who shouldn't have gotten this internship, but who knew everything. It was hilarious. So we were weeping with laughter to have our, you know, highly abstruse debate expertly adjudicated by this chick. I mean, it was just—
That's great.
It was, I mean, it would have been great to have had it on video because it was, I mean, it we can't quite recapitulate how funny it was, but we could achieve this performance anytime because the voice is not gonna change.
Yeah.
She's only gonna get smarter and smarter.
All right. Well, I think this is where we end it.
Yeah.
I want to thank everyone who submitted questions. And if you'd like to help with this show in the future, you can head over to Sam's page on Substack, submit questions, and participate in the online community. See everyone next time. Sam, thanks as always for doing this with me.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.